Coloradans have never elected a Democrat as a U.S. representative in the state's 5th congressional district. Never.
But some are saying that could change this year.
A conversation with one of the candidates for the Democratic Party nomination. Next.
On Loving the Springs, where we celebrate the best of Manitou and Colorado Springs and elevate the rest.
This is Peak Community, Studio 809 Podcast.
Thanks for joining us on Love in the Springs. I'm Carrie Simison.
I'm Al Brody.
And I'm Dave Gardner.
We're recording on February 27th in the fabulous Studio 809 Podcast Community Podcast Studio at the Next Us, a professional cooperative environment for small businesses in downtown Colorado Springs.
At the Next Us, we recognize the needs in our community, and we're each filling different shoes, finding our own way to contribute.
We're joined today by Jessica Killen, candidate for the Democratic Party nomination to run against Jeff Crank to represent Colorado Springs and surroundings in Congress.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, Carrie, Dave, Al. Really appreciate it. It's a beautiful day, and it's great to be here. And thanks for having me.
Why the heck do you want to do this? Why do you want to represent us in Congress?
That's a good question. Well, I'll just say, first and foremost, I'm running because I'm a patriot, and I love my country, and I love Colorado. I love El Paso County. This is the community that raised me, and I believe that we deserve better and more than what we are getting from Jeff Crank right now. Al already mentioned this is going to be a pivotal year. We are going to flip this seat for the first time ever. Very pivotal year for this community, but also for our country, in that we need real, competent, courageous leadership in Congress, and that's what I'm planning to do.
Please share briefly your experience in Colorado Springs history.
I am a fourth generation Colorado native. My great-great-grandparents actually homesteaded up near Greeley. Both my parents went to UNC Greeley, but I actually was born and raised here in Southern Colorado. I was born in Lajara, which is south of Alamosa. My parents were public school educators. My mom was a teacher. My dad ended up becoming principal. We moved here when I was in elementary school. We lived over near Palmer Park initially, went to Carver Elementary, and then Sabin Junior High when it was a junior high. And then my mom was teaching at Pikes Peak Elementary. And then my dad ended up getting his master's, became the principal at Falcon Middle School. We moved out to Stetson Hills, Powers and Barnes, back when it was like dirt roads practically back there. It's funny, I went back to my old house the other day, 6820 Holt Drive, and the trees, you could hardly recognize it. But I grew up out there and went to Horizon Middle School and then graduated from Falcon High School. And when I say that this is the community that raised me, you know, when my parents came to me my junior year in high school and said, "We don't have any money for college," because I'd been surrounded by the Air Force Academy, Fort Carson, Peterson, I thought, okay, a military would be a good opportunity for me, not from a military family. And that is indeed what I did. I then went on to get a 4-year Army ROTC scholarship to pay for college, and then went on to serve my country overseas. And I've had a whole career since then that I think we'll probably end up talking about, but that's my core value. I've been back and forth to Colorado Springs a lot throughout the course of my career and my adult life, and it's great to be home. This is my home. This is the place that raised me, and it's wonderful to be back.
Where'd you go to school, college?
That is a crazy long story. I had put down my $500 deposit at CU Boulder, what everyone did back in that day. When you got a 4-year Army ROTC scholarship back then, it's a completely different system now. But they had a program where basically it paid for either 80% of your tuition or $19,000, whichever was more. And a lot of small private schools throughout the country would write you once you got the scholarship and offer to pay the other 20% and pay your room and board. And the University of Tampa in Florida, where I had never been, I'd never been to the East Coast at this point in my life, offered to basically pay all of the other 20%. And then I got an academic scholarship to pay for my room and board. So I ended up going to a small school in Florida that no one has ever heard of.
Well, when I graduated from Wasson High School here, yeah, I was tired of shoveling snow, so yeah, I went to Texas. I went to SMU in Dallas to go to school, and it took me 20 years to come back. So you ended up on an adventure.
Yes. And
what did you do when you got out of school? Tell us a little bit about
your military. Yeah, so then I served
military.
In the military. Yeah. So I was a military police officer and paratrooper, served mostly overseas. I was a platoon leader and working as part of Operation Joint Endeavor, Joint Guard. So that was UN peacekeeping operations in the Balkans. And then, interestingly, as a company executive officer, company commander, did a lot of work in Central Europe as part of NATO expansion. This is when we expanded NATO to include Poland, back in 1999, which has been a critical ally in the war in Ukraine, and then laid the groundwork for a bigger expansion to NATO in 2004, which included a bunch of Eastern Bloc countries, notably not Ukraine. But, you know, this is something when I think about formative experiences in my life, when I was in Europe, this was a time when people remembered the Marshall Plan and people understood the gravity of the NATO alliance, the importance of these alliances, and how critical they are, not just to global stability, but to our own national security. And it's something I think about a lot, given the way we're engaging with or not engaging with our allies right now. I am deeply concerned that the void that we are leaving with NATO and other alliances is going to be filled. And I see it already being filled by Xi Jinping and China. And it's deeply concerning to me about the future of our globe and the global order, but also our own national security. Then I came back to the States after serving overseas to go to law school. And this is a sort of CU Boulder comes up twice. I was going to go to Boulder, but then I got into Georgetown. And the rule of thumb generally is to go to the best school you get into. So that's what I did. And it's actually how I ended up spending a decent chunk of my career in DC. Should I keep going?
Well, I just wanted to say I'm sorry that you had to spend so much time in DC.
I know. So much. That's another nice part about being back home. Not being there. Yeah.
And yet you're trying to go back.
No. Just part of the time.
Where are your parents?
My parents, interestingly, so after my dad, I think this was probably when I was in the Army. I don't remember the exact timing. He ended up being recruited to go open Thunder Ridge Middle School up in Cherry Creek. And so they moved to Aurora. This was when I was either in the Army or in law school. And then they moved back down. He was a director of schools in Douglas County, and they lived off of the Happy Canyon exit. And now they've just recently downsized, and they're in Centennial now. And both of my sisters are in Denver and Centennial also now, too, as well. Because I'm fourth generation, part of moving home has also been not just to be close to my parents and my sisters, but my aunts, uncles, cousins. My grandparents were here before they passed. So it's just great to be surrounded by so many family members across the state.
You have some pretty impressive DC experience.
Thank you, I guess.
Can you?
That means I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of the place.
I suppose, yeah. Can you give us the Cliff Notes version of that?
Well, after graduating from law school, I practiced law for a few years. I was in the private sector for about 13 years, a few years practicing law, and then a decade at USAA, which actually brought me back here quite a bit. I started there right before the financial crisis and worked a lot on financial services policy and shoring up the financial security of veterans and service members. But I was also there at a really interesting time. The CEO at the time was a guy named Joe Robles, who had started his career as an Army private. And I don't know if you're USAA members, but USAA started as an officer-only company. And Joe felt like it was important that we expand USAA membership to enlisted soldiers. And so this was a period of extensive growth for USAA and also changing. Oh, thank you. All right. Al's a USAA member. I love it. And we worked a lot on developing products at the bank that were geared toward junior enlisted soldiers in particular and helping them establish credit. It's such a critical part, and it's hard when you're a junior enlisted soldier to get loans. And so worked on secure cards that would keep them from going to payday lenders, loans that were tied to financial literacy programs, all things that help them get banked, essentially. So I was there for a decade. Then I wanted to come back during Trump 1.0, but I was dating my husband, Raj, and so stayed in D.C. for a little bit longer and did some jobs that I think, first and foremost, make me uniquely qualified to be an effective member of Congress. But also, I don't think I'd be running for Congress had I not had these jobs. During the first Trump midterms, I felt a call to serve again and became the chief of staff for a woman named Donna Shalala, who you might recall was the HHS secretary in the Clinton administration, but she also was part of that big, huge class in 2018 that flipped the House, and worked for her as her chief of staff, opened up her office, hired everybody, ran her operation. She lost in 2020. This was when Miami and South Florida were switching further right. And then did some other jobs on the Hill on January 6, 2021. To me, another very formative experience in my career and my life. And then taught law school at Georgetown for a little bit, taught federal legislation, and then returned and worked as a chief of staff for another woman who won a very tough seat in 2022, won a Trump plus six seat. And so that was my first experience of what it takes to win a seat that's never been held by a Democrat before, just going back to that. Mm-hmm. And also what it takes to succeed and be a good steward of a community in a seat like this. And then I was recruited to be over at the White House, and I was Doug Emhoff's chief of staff for the last year and a half of the Biden administration about. And so now here I am. And all of that is to say, as a kid who grew up on the east side of Colorado Springs in a middle-class family, child of public school educators, I've gotten to live my version of the American dream. Everybody has their own version. It's not all about money, but through a lot of hard work and perseverance, but also through some luck and tools in my toolbox, I've gotten to do all these really unique and incredible things. And I just know that there are so many people across our community and across our country who feel like the American dream is out of reach now and feel like the policies, and I know that the policies of this administration and the policies of Jeff Crank are making that even harder for most people. I also know that as a mom, my kids, they're the first generation that is expected to do less well than their parents. And we have a lot of work to do. Our nation's coming up on our 250th birthday is at a crossroads. And going back to the first thing I said, that I'm a patriot, I want more for this community and I want more for our country at this pivotal time.
With all of that passion and experience, is it possible to unseat the GOP incumbent? And how do you do that?
It absolutely is. And in case you missed it, the National Democratic Party, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, for the first time in history, has put this district on its districts and playlist. It's on the national map. And that is for a reason. Also, the Cook Political Report, which tracks these types of races, has made this district competitive for the first time ever. And that is simply because Jeff Crank is not doing his job. And I'll just go quickly back to the 2018 class when I worked for Donna. We won districts like this across the country. Hopefully you saw that Abigail Spanberger did the response to the State of the Union mm-hmm. the other night. Her district is very similar to this. This is the fastest Democratic trending district in the entire country. And it is rated what we call an R+5. It still favors Republicans, but by 5 points. Abigail Spanberger, just to give you a sense, since we're just talking about her, won an R+6 district in 2018. This is very much what we would call a swing district in a cycle like this. And Jeff Crank is simply not doing the work. He's not engaged with our community. He is not out talking to people. When I think about the job of a member of the House of Representatives, the core piece of that is actually being engaged in your community, not just listening to the people who agree with you, but talking to the people who disagree with you and who might be skeptical and who might have different opinions. And I think the way we do it is you engage, obviously, the Democratic base. But what's more important is 52% of our electorate here are unaffiliated voters. So engaging with the unaffiliated, listening to them, what their concerns about the community are, and engaging Republicans. And I think I'm uniquely able to do that in that I grew up here when this district was ruby red. And then I went into the Army, and then I served 10 years at USAA. All of those are pretty conservative places. And I'm very comfortable talking to people who disagree with me, talking to Republicans, engaging with Republicans. I understand the way Republicans think and work. And I think that's an important component of winning a race like this. And also, part of that is finding common ground with people. They may disagree with me on 5 things, but we can find another 5 that we do agree on.
Now, Jeff Crank has done a good job of following in Doug Lamborn's footsteps.
Yes.
What is it? Why is the tradition here to not be around?
I think because, and this is the dirty little secret, I think. There's a lot of dirty little secrets about Congress, but safe seats tend to not get the attention that they deserve. The members of Congress tend to not do the hard work that they should be doing to represent their communities. But, you know, flag here, the alert is that this is no longer a safe seat and Jeff Crank should be doing more work. You cannot continue to follow in the Doug Lamborn footsteps and continue to hold this seat. You actually need to do the work. You actually need to be engaged in your community. And he's simply not doing it. In addition to that, he has not proven himself to have any courage, any competency to actually do the job in Washington. I think the other piece of being an effective member of Congress is to actually be a good steward of taxpayer dollars, engage in actually putting oversight over the executive branch. And not only are Jeff Crank and the current Republicans in the House, they're not just a rubber stamp. They are literally getting steamrolled by this administration. And we need people in Congress who care about making Congress work again, making sure Congress does its job of tax and spend oversight, war powers, taking back the power of Congress. And as someone who, you know, spent some of my career in and around Congress. We need people who give a crap about making Congress do its job, and that is clearly not Jeff Crank.
Now, if you're elected, then you're going to spend 2 years, hopefully a Democratic majority in Congress,
yep.
but 2 more years with you-know-who
yep.
as president.
Yep.
Can you do anything?
Yes. I think there's a lot of things, and I talk a lot about where almost every day Jeff Crank is failing us in ways that things that I would clearly do. First of all, putting a check on the tariffs. That is the tax and spend authority of Congress. And this Congress and Jeff Crank multiple times have voted to allow Trump to run roughshod over Congress and do whatever he does with tariffs that ultimately are not working for our community and are not working for our country. And they are regressive. They have an outsized impact on lower income people and on small businesses. I hear from small business owners throughout our community all the time about the costs of doing business, and their supply chain has gone up 60, 70%. It's killing our small businesses. And Jeff Crank is doing absolutely nothing about it. In addition to that, Space Command, obviously, the move has been announced, but it's not done yet. And I'm not scared of Donald Trump. I don't know why he is. It's time to have someone who's actually going to go to bat for our community. And he's simply not doing that. In addition to that, I really believe that flipping the House will take the pressure off some of the more what I would call normal Republicans in Congress.
Oh, there's still some left?
Yeah, they're there. Right now, they're really under the gun. They have such a small margin. And you have to be optimistic to run for Congress, I've decided. And I'm a big believer that when we do flip the House, that'll take some of the pressure off for people to actually work across the aisle and get some results-oriented legislation done and put in some basic checks on the cronyism, the corruption, the lawlessness, and the overreach of this administration that we're seeing literally every day.
Wow. So the Democrats did an autopsy of what happened in the last election.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they found was that the young Democrats did not vote.
Mm-hmm.
How do you fix that in this community, in this district?
Yeah. Well, young voters, this is a perpetual problem. This is not a new problem.
But this wasn't young
yeah.
voters.
Right.
This was
young
Democrats because yeah. they didn't feel that the Democratic candidate was far left enough.
Yeah. I think that's part of it. I also think there's a number of young Democratic-leaning voters who also feel very disaffected by government generally and feel that they feel like government politicians generally are putting politics over people and are not focused on the things that they care about, which are, you know, getting a good job out of college or out of high school and being able to make a life and live the American dream. Also about our climate and climate change, they feel like there's not enough attention for their futures. And what we need to do, you cannot win with just a message from the left. We've got to engage those folks and talk about what's actually going to move the ball forward for them and what will actually work, and pragmatic, results-oriented legislation and policies. And we need to reach young voters where they are, listen to them. I'm a big believer. Do I agree with all of the positions of sort of the far left part of the party? No. But I think we need to listen and engage with them. And I think that's part of the problem, is that they didn't feel heard. They didn't feel like people were at least listening and engaging with them in a real way. And that's the hard part of this, right? But we have to get into a place where it is okay to disagree, but let me tell you about how my policies are going to move the ball forward for your life better than the policies of Jeff Crank or of Donald Trump. And I think young voters are now, or young non-voters, are understanding that elections do have consequences. And the consequences of this one have been stark. Yeah.
How do you appeal to those young voters and the rank and file, the average everyday Americans out there, without alienating the billionaire class who you're going to need to line your pockets once you're in Congress?
Well, that's terrible. And I will say that's one of the things I talk about all the time. When I was at the White House, you know, very different White House than the current White House, we had a rule. It was a very strict rule that if you were working there, you couldn't own stock. And you couldn't trade stock, obviously, because you couldn't own it. You can have a 401k or something like that. So my husband and I, to the extent we did own some stock, we sold it, we divested it. And that's the way it should run across the board. Public service is public service for a reason. You shouldn't be enriching yourself. And we are seeing like the worst, right now, like we have seen the Trump family has essentially, by some estimates, enriched themselves $4 billion in the first year of the Trump presidency, which is, to me, is just disgusting. But we need people, and this goes actually to the young voter piece also, people don't have faith in their governmental institutions and in their public service leaders anymore. And we need to reestablish legitimacy and people's faith in their government. And one of those ways is to put across the board rules on Congress, on the executive branch, and in the judiciary against enriching yourself for being in public service, because that's not what it's about.
I'll give you a tough question because I don't really have a good answer to this in my own head. Tallarico or Crockett?
Oh, geez. That's a tough one.
It is.
I really like Tallarico. That's just me personally. I think that he really speaks Texas. I consider Texas sort of like El Paso County, where you've sort of been watching it shift to the left for a while. But I don't know if they're quite ready for a firebrand like Jasmine Crockett. I think they want someone who, in the way Tallarico weaves faith into his messaging, I think is really important, faith and morality. And I think he's an amazing communicator.
Fair enough.
Well, we'll see how it all unfolds.
That's true.
So with the level of distrust of our government these days, your experience in D.C., it could be a plus or it could be a big negative.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can say to give us some comfort that you're not an insider that's going to just continue the system that we're growing to hate?
Well, first, I think the first thing I say is part of why I'm running is because I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of Washington, D.C. I know things that are not working. And I'm just going to go back to my very first North Star. I'm a patriot. And I believe we deserve better from our leaders, both on the left and the right. And why people ask me, are you moderate? Are you progressive? I'm team normal. I want things to work. And I've been watching things not work for a long time. And we all have. And I don't know about you, when I wake up in the morning, I sort of get nervous before I go to my phone about what's on there. And I think people want a government that works for them. They want less chaos. They want to actually just go about their lives and not have to think about how stressed they are about what's going on in Washington. I think we're at an interesting inflection point in that this administration has broken so many of our core institutions in government and has sort of through DOGE and other things that we're in an interesting point where I think instead of going back to the norm, which I think also wasn't working, this is an interesting point where we can actually grow and build something new and better.
We
need courageous leaders to do that.
Do you think it's possible to have a Congress that has an agenda that really includes the big fixes that need to happen? And you may not agree with all these, but like term limits, perhaps, getting the money out of elections.
Yeah.
What else would you put on the list?
Well, I'd say we're in a triage situation. So I think the first piece is to put a check on this administration. But I agree that we need to restore faith in our institutions. And as I already talked about stock ownership and stock trading, I think we've seen on both sides of the aisle also people staying in Congress way too long. And what I've seen firsthand is you get there, and especially if you're in a safe district, you're not engaging with your community and you get sort of out of touch with what the needs of your community are, what real people need. And so I think term limits could serve an important role in sort of curbing that. I don't know if you're aware, the Virginia governorship is a one-term limited job. And I think that is too little time, right? As soon as you figure out the job, you're out of there, right? And so you've got to figure out the right balance of being effective at the job and knowing how to communicate with people up on Capitol Hill and in the community, but also then when you're getting a little too long in the tooth or you've gotten out of touch with your constituents, then it's time to go. And I think also, though, creating clear ethics rules might also change some of the comfort of Congress and return it to a point where it's actually a true public service job.
I get the feeling sometimes they didn't really run in order to do good for the country. They just thought, wow, here's a cushy job. I get elected. I get great insurance. I get a pension and I don't have to do anything. Are there people doing that?
No, I'll just say, I'm not going to defend longtime politicians very much ever. But I do believe most people, both on the left and the right, started out with the right intentions. They do want to engage in public service. They do want to do better for their community. And I think what we do need to work, though, is once you get in the system, how to make sure, and I think gerrymandering has been a huge part of this, right? And that we have all these non-competitive seats where people then are not forced to do the hard work that you have to do. And when you're in a seat like this, for better or for worse, and I think it's for better for our community, you have to work. You have to work to get reelected, and that means engaging with your community and actually taking votes, bucking your own party. And I'm not afraid to buck the Democrats or the Republicans to do right by this community. And we need more seats like this, because that actually serves the community and actually gets members who are then actually truly focused on creating results for their country and their community.
So does that mean you feel 2-year terms is smart for Congress? I'm thinking 2 years is too short.
2 years is way too, this is another thing, and I was talking to some people about this yesterday about, you mentioned money in politics. The way the system works right now, like, we do need to get rid of Citizens United and dark money, and the Republican Party takes advantage of that much more than the Democratic Party. But I'm going to be running this race for close to 2 years. And then when I get elected, and I'll immediately start raising money again and doing it again.
Yeah.
And it is exhausting. I think it's important. You have to raise money, right? To run an effective campaign on a podcast right now, but mostly politically engaged people are going to be listening to this, right? So you have to raise money to communicate with people who don't even know there's an election in 2026, right? And to engage with younger voters, and all of that costs money to hire a great staff. My campaign manager is here, and pay them well and provide health care to them.
Emily, are you making the big bucks over there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you don't get rich doing that.
But there should be some way to sort of rein some of that in. And when I was stationed in Germany, most of Europe has very strict rules about how long the campaign season is. It's like a max of 90 days or 120 days, something like that. And to me, the great thing about that is then it forces people to actually govern and focus on governing. And then the period of time for actually running a race and raising money and doing all that is more truncated. Mm-hmm. I think we'd have to look at, then, can you actually communicate? The problem there is that you have very engaged voters in Europe in a way we don't always hear in the United States.
What?
And so I think that's the one thing, is I think it's important to reach to disengaged voters. And right now, the only way to do that is through advertising and knocking on doors, which also costs money.
Yeah.
Doug Lamborn had a field of people in the primary that he ran against. Mm-hmm. And he was, to me, the craziest, as in what I'm trying to say in crazy is the furthest to the right that you could possibly be, maybe over the edge. Mm-hmm. And that was Doug Lamborn. And he destroyed everybody else, which shocked me, but he did. And this is a state where Lauren Boebert has won.
Yep.
And I think another person who I assess as being over the edge, yet she won. You give me more hope for this election than anybody else that we've connected with.
Thank you.
And over the years, it's been quite a few.
Yep.
But I think you've got this breadth and depth of what it takes at this moment. My wife and my daughter are both really hurting.
Yeah.
Watching what's happening. And I can't speak for all women, but I think all women are saying, this has to stop.
Right.
This is insanity, and nothing seems to be happening. Yep. And I deal with their deep emotions.
Yep.
So the fact that you're a woman, no matter what your perspective is, you are that. I don't think you can step out of that.
No.
And I think that gives you this moment in time, you're in the perfect place at the perfect time.
Well, I hope you're right. And I think what's interesting, we talked about Lamborn, I'll talk quickly about Crank. I think this is one of the things that makes him uniquely vulnerable in the community that is now essentially truly a community that's moved to the left and that is a true swing district, is that if we all recall in 2024, Jeff Crank had a primary from the right in Dave Williams. And this is a conservative place, but it is not MAGA. And I think that's what people sometimes have lost touch. I'm not saying there's not MAGA here. So you had a bunch of what I would call sort of normal, true conservatives who helped put Crank over the finish line. And he was perceived as the more moderate. And
yes,
he was more moderate, right? But is the minute he took the oath, he's gone full MAGA. And he's been 100% voting with Trump. And that is not reflective of our community. And it's essentially one of the many reasons that we believe we can win the seat, because people in this community crave, they want someone team normal, right? And what they're getting from Crank is someone who's not standing up to some of these policies that are inherently not conservative. Adding $4.7 trillion to the debt, that is not conservative. The amount of federal government overreach we're seeing with the ICE raids, with Venezuela, you name it, that is not conservative. The lack of rule of law, that is not conservative. Yeah. These are how we communicate with the community and talk about the real change that we need here in our leadership.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Yeah.
So I want to say, we had Zuri Horowitz in here as a guest a month or two ago. We didn't even get around to talking about her campaign at all. We had plenty of other things to talk about. And we'll put a link in the show notes to that. I know you're also visiting with Elevating Pikes Peak Women, one of our fine podcasts.
Yeah.
And I know their questions are going to be completely different than these. And so we'll put a link in the show notes.
Great.
So there's great opportunities to meet some of the candidates. Eventually, we're going to get Joe Regan in here probably.
Great.
And we're going to invite Jeff Crank. We figure there's no rush. He's not...
Not going anywhere yet.
Yeah. We're going to put up with him for a while.
November. Yeah.
So Jeff, you're welcome to come in and visit with us. It'll be interesting to see if he's interested in doing that. So I just wanted to put that on the table. And then I think we have one more question, the most important question.
We do, since you're here. And, and people worry about, well, you lived in D.C., so you're not really here. But what do you love about Colorado Springs?
Well, first and foremost, I realize growing up here, you can sometimes take the beauty, the physical beauty of this place for granted. And I don't, but it's been fun having my husband, who did not grow up here, every time he flies in and out of the airport, he's like, oh my God. And we went to Costco together the other day, as a couple does. And he's, even our Costco is beautiful. So you've got Pikes Peak in the background. And it's fun to watch it through his eyes. He's so enamored of just the physical beauty of the place. I will say, though, the other piece is the people here. This is a really unique place in that the libertarian bent of our community and of Colorado has led to this unique mix of, we have a really dedicated philanthropic network here. Much of it is faith-based, which is also something that makes our community really unique. But people really are looking out for their neighbors. Have they figured it all out? No. But, you know, I went last night to an event, Pikes Peak Housing Network event, and people from nonprofit sector, the business community, the chamber, faith leaders, all focused on improving housing access, which obviously is a big challenge in our community, but all focused on that. And it was great to see so many different people from so many different walks of life with so many different political views come together to focus on an issue that is really critical to the livelihoods of our community. And I see that everywhere I go and with people I talk to, just the real engagement in philanthropy and caring for this community. And I find it immensely impressive. And this is a special place. The people here are special and the beauty of it is special.
I thought you were going to say Powers Boulevard.
Or Academy.
Or Woodman.
Yeah. No.
So I have a suggestion. And I've been up on Pikes Peak mountain biking.
Yeah.
And since Trump opened up the forest lands to logging, we are logging the Pike National Forest on Pikes Peak. And it hurts. It hurts to see that. And I think that is so short-sighted. But it's happening. If you haven't seen it, you really need to take your husband
up there. Well, I know that Jeff Crank voted to sell off public lands, which to me is just, it's someone who clearly, once again, is not in touch with his community. And this is something that's so important here.
Yeah, that was just absolutely painful for me to see.
Well, we need to wrap it up so that you can take a break before Elevating Pikes Peak Women have their way with you. Where do people go if they want to follow your campaign?
Killinforcolorado.com. I'm also on all the social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, X, Twitter, whatever we are calling it these days, Blue Sky, Threads, and would love to have people's support. We are on the ballot on June 30th in the primary, and then, of course, on November 3rd.
When will we know for sure that the field has been whittled somewhat in this
process? That should come at the end of March. Accessing the ballot in Colorado is a unique process. You have the petition process. We turned in all our signatures close to a couple of weeks ago. We haven't heard back from the Secretary of State's office yet, but we feel confident about that. We submitted 3,500 signatures, and we pre-validated through our great volunteer force that we have over 2,000. So we're very comfortable about where we're at in terms of accessing the ballot. The other way you can do it is caucusing. If you petition, you have to get at least 10% at caucuses if you decide to caucus. And then if you don't petition, you have to do 30%. That will all be done, that whole process. The petition deadline is March 18th. The County Assembly, where we do the full vote on the delegates, is March 14th. So we should know by the end of March, early April.
And when you're Speaker of the House, we hope you'll come back and visit with us from time to time.
What about the term limits?
You're going to have to, well, keep that in mind. You're going to have to be in a hurry. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it. This has been great.
Well, it's great to have Hala Ershadi from the Pikes Peak Bulletin in the studio with us again.
It's great to be here.
Yeah.
This is becoming a habit.
Yeah. That's a good habit.
It is.
What the heck's going on out there?
There's a lot going on out there, but what I thought I'd talk with you about today is a follow-up to a conversation we had earlier about the archives of the Colorado Springs Independent, which I know several of you here have deep ties to, and yeah. I know we all were really rooting for these archives to be restored. So just to give a little background to listeners, back in December, the Pikes Peak Bulletin reported that the current owner of the Colorado Springs Independent Archives, which was a progressive alt-weekly that started in the 90s and ran until about 2023 when it folded, was briefly revitalized and then folded again. All of these wonderful archives with investigative journalism, community voices, arts and culture reporting that really just was one of its kind. All of that disappeared following what I understand to be a poorly executed website migration. But the person that owns the archives now, which is Dirk Hobbs with Colorado Media Group, back in December was feeling pretty hopeful that these archives could be restored and was ready to get to work on that. Hobbs did not bring the Colorado Springs Independent back as anything like what it was. He rebranded it as the SoCo Insider. It does arts and entertainment and sort of like lifestyle coverage, not investigative journalism. But Hobbs did say he understood the importance to the community and was going to bring these archives back. Well, I have a sad update to that story this week. Hobbs told the Bulletin that when they got in there and started trying to restore the archives, he said it was, and I quote, a complete mess. But there
I'll bet
are
you he
some...
used other words than that even.
That was the on-the-record quote. But there are digital issues from 2023 that are accessible with no paywall. There had been talk of a possible paywall. That is not part of the equation at socoinsider.com. They're not searchable individual articles. Some listeners may be familiar with the issue platform where you can read an electronic edition of various publications. So that's what Hobbs is using to restore these archives. Right now, there's 1 year of editions and they are searchable within the edition. So if you had an idea of which issue a particular story might be in, you could go find that on the website, if it's in 2023, and search in that issue and pop it right back up. So it's better than nothing. It's not what one would hope for, but it does seem like some of the issues, it's not quite clear to what degree yet, are going to be available in that way. But unfortunately, a lot of the files are what Hobbs described as severely scattered. And he said it's just a vast quantity of data, nearly 7 terabytes, which today's desktop computers typically come with 1 to 2 terabytes of data storage that are not organized. Some files are corrupted. Hobbs said that it's taking an inordinate amount of time piecing them together. It's proving to be a massive undertaking since the files were not done in a consistent manner through the years as technology evolved. But he and his team will continue to post additional more recent issues as they are able.
That's a huge bummer. I wonder if I'm trying to remember the name of the kind of first digital company we worked with on website. I wonder if they're still even in existence and if they've been reached out to, or just because the ownership has changed now enough times of the archives, if it's just code in the ether versus something that company could even still make sense of.
I'm thinking that now that the FBI isn't investigating Epstein anymore, maybe they could work on this. We need that level of investigation, I think. I can understand why it would be daunting, more than daunting. And as far as business model goes for Dirk Hobbs, there's no return on that investment at all, I don't think.
No, it's really just history of record and, yeah.
An important gift.
25 years of local investigative journalism, but yeah.
Important to the community. So I want to say thank you, Dirk Hobbs, for giving it this effort. Please don't give up. But wow, I just don't know whether we're going to ever get a happy ending to that fairy tale.
Is this an example of the frailty of our history? This is just one tiny example of what could happen to our electronically stored history.
Well, there was a copy of every paper edition in the basement at the Indy. And of course, the question was, well, where can that be stored? And of course, digital is more searchable and accessible to everybody. So
it is until it's gone.
Yeah. It could be that the paper copies in a post-apocalyptic world will be glad to have the paper.
There are a lot of paper copies at the Pioneers Museum, and I believe the Library District also has quite a few. So I have heard some concerned community members say, well, maybe we can cobble it together if you can scan these hard copies into a PDF. Potentially that could be searchable. It would be a massive undertaking, but it might be the only route to restore some of these stories.
Yeah, I think I smell a grant. This community needs a grant for that to happen.
And who would be funding that grant?
Pointer or Knight, or there's a few foundations out there that are really committed to good journalism, and it could be appealing to them.
Well, there's definitely community interest. I know a lot of people, including those of us in this room, understand what happens when all this historical community knowledge is lost. I regularly wish I could search the independent archives for the stories I'm doing today because I know there's valuable information in them and they could inform our current reporting and our current watchdogging of community events. And it's just a tragedy that we don't have that.
Yeah. And I'm sure Pam Zubek gets tired of everybody running over to her house and saying, hey, let's get out the hard drive. Which I'm sure doesn't exist.
Pam is very patient with me because I am that person that goes to her for background. And definitely there are people like Pam being a main one, who do carry a lot of that historical knowledge. But you can't write important stories for 30 years and remember everything. So just there's no replacing these archives.
And I'm sure someone, like, does any of this live in the Wayback Machine, like when you search the way back by particular dates at csindy.com?
Yeah, or is that
missing too?
Yeah.
I'm sure someone has thought of it, but
I have heard that people have searched on that and I don't think it has yielded great results. There might be some things, but it's not a trove.
Yeah. Man, I'm going to dig through my dusty brain files and see if I can remember even the people that we worked with in the beginning and maybe just find them on LinkedIn and see if they have any advice.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem was there were probably, over time, at least probably three different vendors that the Indy used.
Oh, yeah.
That. Yeah. And it was always challenging. It's kind of like, heck, Intuit can't even upgrade Quicken or QuickBooks without having to completely remake your files. So imagine what it's like as the technology improved for newspapers online.
I did read the piece. And grateful that he's trying, but a little bit of a deflation when you realize all that work is possibly lost forever.
Yeah, it is amazing that he's trying. So thanks. Thank you, Jerk, for that.
Corey Hutchins, who does the News Behind the News, he's with Colorado College, the journalism program there. He pointed out in his recent newsletter that this is a huge cautionary tale, especially as the world moves fully into digital, to make sure those precious digital bits of information are preserved properly so that this is not an occurrence that happens in the future.
Yeah, what happens when the Washington Post goes out of business?
Whatever God Jeff Bezos forbid. Wants to happen, yeah. That's what will happen.
He's got access to a lot of cloud technology, or the New York Times, or the Gazette. If that company goes out of business, those digital archives go away if there isn't something in place to pay for the ongoing storage of that data and hosting of it. What other scoops have you got for us? Anything else?
Well, we have been following the Marino and Cascade urban renewal plan that went in front of city council. So there was a neighborhood group called the Mill Street Community Benefits All Coalition, and they really turned out for this meeting to say the things that they've been saying publicly for months, which is that they are not opposed to the urban renewal plan, which includes quite a bit, millions, actually $10 million of public money to go to infrastructure improvements related to the construction of a Catbird hotel, and then several million more for a phase two that would include some attainable housing, which is distinct from affordable housing in that it is aimed more at middle income rather than lower income people and families. Mm-hmm. The URA was approved despite quite a number of folks standing up and asking for council to delay the vote for there to be more time for the coalition and the developer, which is Norwood Development Group, to potentially work out a community benefits agreement, which is a legally binding document that could assure or attempt to assure that existing residents are not heavily impacted or displaced by rising property values and essentially what you would call gentrification that frequently happens when an area that has historically not been heavily invested in becomes very invested in. And there was a lot of smart public comments from people with different perspectives at the city council meeting. There were several neighborhood members who stood up and said, well, I am in favor of this project. I do want my property values to go up. I appreciate what development brings. It brings, you know, jobs, it's infrastructure improvements, better lighting, better public safety potentially. And then there were many others who said, yes, we like those good things, but we have a life and a history and decades of community, and we don't want to lose that. And in the end, the council did vote to approve the URA. Councilmember Nancy Hengem made a comment that other places do this. They do have community benefits agreements. Sometimes it's even required. But that's not where this council is at this time. And she did also vote to approve the URA.
Was it unanimous then?
It was not. It was a 7-2 vote. Council member Kimberly Gold and council member Dave Donaldson voted no. Donaldson had made a motion to delay the vote for two council meetings, so about a month, mm-hmm. and said he would likely vote for it at that time, but that he was making the motion to give time for more dialogue and perhaps some sort of agreement or at least better feelings at the end of that time. The council did not have a majority vote on that, so did vote for it, and it is a done deal now. But I definitely think that conversation is going to continue. I spoke with Max Kronstadt, who's one of the leaders of the coalition, and he definitely felt like this is not something that people are giving up on. They still want to advocate. And there was someone from a different group that is looking to get a community benefits agreement with a different developer over by the Union Printers home, mm-hmm. which is a large, really ambitious development that has been in the works for some years. It's not very clear like when that may come to fruition is my understanding, but the plans are in the works. It is moving forward. And there is a community group there that is advocating similarly to say, we want some guarantees that this development that will alter this neighborhood in some really great ways, but also could create some of the issues that are known to occur with that kind of development. They want to get that agreement for their neighborhood as well.
All right. Well, thanks for keeping us posted on that. And if anybody wants to follow these stories and the other great coverage, they just need to go to heroiclocaljournalism.org. Is that right? Is that your website?
We need to get that one and have it maybe redirect to the one we have now, which is pikespeakbulletin.org. And if you go there, we post stories most days, new stories, original journalism. Oh, one thing that I'm really excited about is we're getting more and more smart opinion pieces from community members. And if anyone out there listening has an opinion that they want to articulate to our audience, I encourage them to get in touch with me. It's Hayla, which is not spelled how you'd think. It's H-E-I-L-A at pikespeakbulletin.org. You can also sign up for our weekly e-newsletter on our website, pikespeakbulletin.org, and you'll get the week's top stories delivered to your inbox.
Oh boy, I'm excited about that opinion section. I might have to sharpen my pencil.
Me too.
We don't have any opinions here. Thanks a lot, Hayla.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Well, thanks so much for listening to Loving the Springs. We love you guys.
Stay engaged.
Pay attention.
Carry on.